As I mentioned there at the outset, more than 760 incidents involving antisocial behaviour occurred on the country's rail network during the first 6 months of this year. They included multiple reports of fighting, soiling, sexual harassment, lewd behaviour and hate incidents on trains, many of which involved drugs or alcohol, we're told. Well, Barry Kenny of Irish Rail Communications joins us now. Good afternoon, Barry.
Hi, Owen.
Nearly half of these incidents, we're told, took place on DART services in Dublin, while the remainder occurred on Irish Rail's intercity routes, according to records released under the Freedom of Information laws. Tell us a little bit more about the background to these figures.
Well, as you say, the very serious incidents you describe thankfully take up a tiny proportion of the overall incidents. The bulk of antisocial behaviour does tend to be those kind of more boisterous behaviour matters that don't pose an actual threat to the safety of customers or employees are obviously very much of disturb other customers and indeed can create a very unpleasant atmosphere. Alcohol is, of course, I think in all kinds of antisocial behaviour in society, never mind public transport, always a significant factor, and we're no different in that regard. While the headline figure is there, one thing that's important to note is that we are seeing the serious incidents reduce. We've been putting more resources to addressing antisocial behaviour in terms of more security, in terms of more joint patrols with the Gardaí, in terms of very much proactive programmes with the Gardaí in terms of their support and attendance with us in our stations and on our trains. And that is starting to have an effect in reducing incidents at a time when more people are travelling. That division between the DART and the rest of the network pretty much kind of mirrored the actual passenger journey numbers as well. So I suppose, you know, for people thinking about travelling by rail, appreciate the reports of antisocial behaviour can seem worrying, but the vast majority of journeys do happen without incident, and we are putting more and more resources towards addressing any issues where they do occur.
Yeah, more than 50 incidents since the beginning of the year involved fighting, including one that was described as an intoxication related on the DART at Lansdowne Road on the night of the 8th of July. That's after Westlife had performed at the nearby Aviva Stadium. The records also reveal a pattern of lewd behaviour on the Mallow to Tralee route during the first half of 2022. Lewd behaviour was the subject of 16 complaints over the 6 month period, six of which related to DART services. A total of six incidents involved soiling, four of which occurred in the DART. Now, I know, Barry, and you touched on it there, that Irish Rail has spent €5.7 million on security in the last year. Is there an argument to be made, and I know the NBRU are calling for dedicated transport police. Is it time we looked at that, in your opinion?
Well, I suppose the Gardaí are the experts in terms of the structure of policing. From our point of view, the important issue is, do we get the support, do we get both in terms of, you know, proactive and preventative initiatives, and also in response to any incidents. And I have to say that the additional resources the Gardaí have put to this area, very much using the community policing model, has been exceptional in recent times. So that's our priority. I think, you know, the idea that a transport police of itself prevents antisocial behaviour, unfortunately, that simply isn't the case. The issue is that whatever policing structure is in place, that the support and the resources are there. So, I mean, we've established, for example, on the intercity network, and you know, a lot of our services that operate through Kildare to Cork, to Limerick, to Galway, and indeed on the commuter routes themselves through Kildare, we have rapid response hubs now with Gardaí, whereby our staff on the trains have a direct point of contact in Garda stations that enable that response to happen. We've established a joint hub between ourselves, the Gardaí, Lewis and Dublin Bus at Houston, so that there's a collective effort there to address issues and basically to prevent issues from developing in terms of if something appears to be developing, that we have resources there. A very important development we have as well is that the Gardaí will actually be moving in and jointly located with us in our new National Train Control Centre at Houston. In fact, the Gardaí are the first to occupy that building in Houston. And again, it just shows the kind of depths of cooperation that are there. So, you know, we will be confident that this kind of reducing trend will continue. We do think there were particular issues through the time of COVID, particularly in terms of loitering, when a lot of things weren't open, when you had kind of people, groups, youths in particular, basically at a loose end, but with nothing to go to or nothing to do. And we had a lot of loitering incidents as a result. So that certainly has eased off. And we'll continue to put those resources in place to make it a safer travelling environment for customers and a safer working environment for staff as possible. Because it's crucial. We talk about customer service, but keeping people safe is really the first part of customer service, which is why we're putting those extra resources to it.
Yeah, as I say, spending on security resources has increased by 50% in the past 5 years, from €3.7 million in 2016 to €5.7 million last year. And those joint patrols with Gardaí have been established, particularly on the Dart and the Houston commuter services, which go through Kildare. And indeed, we would have seen Gardaí working with Irish Rail aboard trains. I just want to note as well that hate incidents which target people based on characteristics such as ethnicity, nationality, disability or sexual orientation were reported 5 times over the same period. On one occasion, this resulted in a passenger being removed from a train just over the border at Portlaoise. Before we let you go, Barry, if people are on trains going in and out of Dublin or around the country, if they notice antisocial behaviour or anything that should be reported, there are mechanisms in place that they can contact the Gardaí or any of the services there.
Yes, I mean, what we see in the Dublin area on the Dart and on the commuter routes, including the Kildare and Maynooth commuter routes, text the word train followed by details of the incident of 51444. That obviously allows customers to discreetly report issues. It goes directly to our security monitoring centre, who coordinate our own security response and work with Gardaí as well. On our intercity services, almost all now, and we will very shortly have all intercity services with customer services officers on board. So that means a staff member is present, obviously, while their focus is on ensuring people have a pleasant journey. If any issues arise, it means that there's somebody there to report to, so it can be escalated if there's a need for support from security and from Gardaí. And the one thing I would say, if people genuinely, and it's extremely rare, thankfully, but if it's a genuine situation where people feel that their safety is under threat, to alert Gardaí directly as well is an option there. But our priority and our focus is on reducing incidents, stopping them before they start, and we'll continue to work with the Gardaí and security on that.
All right, that is Barry Kenny of Irish Rail Communications joining us there on that issue. Over 760 antisocial behaviour incidents on train services reported in the first 6 months of this year. Barry, thanks for joining us and good afternoon. Áine Dunnigan, if you're listening in to us in Rathangan, I have picked up on your message. I was aware that that meeting was being organised. That's something we've covered on Kildare Today, so we'll be returning to it on the Kildare Today programme tomorrow morning between 9 and 11 o'clock. And what I will do is give you a call after this programme, which finishes up at 3 o'clock. So you might just text me in to let me know that you've heard this, and you know that I'll give you a ring, and obviously you're aware of what that's about. Lads, what's the story out on the M7 there around Newbridge? Traffic was pretty much at a standstill. I think it's more or less sorted now, but it was at a standstill there just on the M7 heading northbound before the M9 merged. There was a crash, but that seems to be sorted now, and traffic is quite heavy in Newbridge and also quite heavy on the Kildare Town to Nerney Road out around the townland of Kilburn and Clonolan. So if anyone has any more information there on those two incidents or those two reports of heavy traffic on the road between Kildare Town and Nerney, what's happening there, and on the M7 heading northbound just before the merge at Newbridge, it would appear as though traffic is quite heavy, but that is being alleviated. Do get in touch with us. Now, just to go to an issue that we would have spoken about on Kildare Today this morning, but Gardaí are once again renewing their appeal for witnesses or any information following two separate incidents in Robertstown and Strafford over the weekend. We have an update on the Robertstown situation that we'll bring to you in a few moments' time. But first of all, Superintendent Oliver Henry at Naas Garda Station has this message and appeal.
Gardaí in County Kildare would like to appeal for the public's assistance in relation to two separate incidents which happened over the weekend. The first was an endangerment incident which happened on the evening of Friday the 26th of August at approximately 11:45 p.m. on the R403 close to the Barbastown roundabout in Strathen. During this incident, Gardaí were in the process of seizing a vehicle when a male attempted to drive the vehicle from the scene. A Garda member who had attempted to stop it was carried upon the vehicle for some distance before falling off and receiving significant injuries. The Garda member was taken to Naas General Hospital and thankfully has been released since to recover at home. Gardaí subsequently located the vehicle after it was involved in a single vehicle collision in Strathen village. A man in his 20s was subsequently arrested on the morning of Saturday, 27th of August, 2022. And Gardaí are appealing for any witnesses to this incident to come forward. Also appealing for any road users who may have camera footage, including dash cam, and were travelling in the Strathen Barbastown Cross area and the Strathen Village area between 11:40pm and 12:15am on Friday night. Gardaí would ask that any persons who can assist in this investigation will contact Leixlip Garda Station on 01 666 7800, the Garda confidential line 1 1800 666 111, or any Garda station. The second incident which we are asking for assistance from the public for was a serious assault on a male that happened in Robertstown on Sunday, 28th of August, 2022. At approximately 2:30am that morning, a man in his 30s was seriously assaulted and injured at a residence in Father Murphy Park in Robertstown. The injured male was taken to Talley University Hospital, where he is currently in a stable condition. Gardaí are also appealing for any road users who have camera footage, including dash cam, who are in the Robertstown area between 1am and 4am, to make this footage available, and for any witnesses also to contact Naas Garda Station on 045 884 300, the Garda confidential line on 1 800 666 111, or any Garda station. So to recap, there are two incidents. The first one is the endangerment incident in Barbastown roundabout in Strathen area on Friday night, approximately 11:45pm. Any witnesses are asked to contact Leixlip Station for that. And the second incident was the serious assault on the male in Robertstown that happened on Sunday the 28th of August at approximately 2:30am. And anyone who can assist the Gardaí in that is asked to contact Naas Garda Station. Thank you.
Yeah, Superintendent Oliver Henry of Naas Garda Station with that appeal. And the update that we have for you on the Robertstown incident is that three men aged in their 20s, 30s and 50s and two women aged in their 20s and 40s are currently being detained at various Garda stations in Kildare under the provisions of Section 4 of the Criminal Justice Act 1984. The injured male in his 30s is still receiving treatment at Talley University Hospital, where his condition is described as serious but stable. We'll have more on that in our news bulletins throughout the afternoon here on KFM.
Kildare Focus with Owen Beattie.
Children's Books Ireland has launched its pre-budget submission for 2023. The charity is calling on the Department of Education to maintain the €20 million investment that was made in budget 2022 towards rebuilding schools' library stock after over a decade without funding to buy books. On the line is Elena Ryan. She is CEO of Children's Books Ireland. Elena, good afternoon and welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon, Owen. Thanks very much.
So despite the funding that was granted to schools last year, Children's Books Ireland still received almost 650 applications for their school library donation programmes this year. That's still quite a significant number, Elena.
Absolutely. It's the biggest number we've ever had, actually, which is ironic in the year when they actually had some funding from the Department of Education. It's been an awful long time that schools haven't had a sustainable fund that they know they can rely on, that they can plan to have, from the Department of Education for books. Now, we're not talking about textbooks, we're talking about reading for pleasure and the benefits that children and young people get from reading for pleasure, which are just huge and varied, from, you know, literacy and numeracy to opening their imaginations and their own mental well-being after what's been a really tough time. So we're calling on the department to put that $20 million in place this year and in future so that schools can plan their libraries, so that they can have a strategy in place and so that they can respond to what the students actually want to read and to refresh that library when books get old and tattered as well.
Have you got any indication that it may be maintained or any engagement from government?
No, we've launched our campaign today publicly, and we've been engaging with Department of Education through the year to support this first rollout of the 20 million euro. So we've done a lot of work to support schools in working with them on how they can stock their libraries and where to find excellent books. But we haven't got an indication as to whether this is going to become a reality. I mean, we understand that government budgets are stretched this year. We know that we're facing into an energy crisis, the cost of living crisis, the war in Europe. So we understand the constraints. But I suppose where we're coming from is we're looking at things like the Bernardo's Back to School survey and looking at how ordinary families are really under pressure. And books may be seen as a luxury. They may not be an item that homes can afford to purchase. However, that's not to say that government should see them as a luxury. Books are absolutely essential for children and young people in schools, not least to deliver on the curricular obligations that teachers have, but for so many reasons. I think we can maybe underestimate the power of reading and the power of a really brilliant book and what that can do for children.
Yeah, and look, I remember in primary school going to the school library, bringing a few of the books home and doing it as part of maybe the English side of things in primary school, go home, read a couple of pages of the book and come back in and talk about it in school. And as you say, it can be read for pleasure as well. Didn't realise, though, it required that much funding. Where does the 20 million euro come into it?
I suppose when you break it down, 20 million sounds like a very big number until you look at it in real terms per school. So 20 million equates to about 21 euro per student at primary and secondary levels. So if you walk into a bookshop, that might buy you two novels or picture books or graphic novels, or if you're buying non-fiction books, which are generally, hardback, colour illustrated, you might get one book for that. Now, for context, the library organisation in the UK that looks after school libraries recommends about 13 books a head. And when we go into schools and when we hear from them, they're running on donations. They're running on teachers' own money to buy the books. And when you run a book on donations, what you're getting in is used copies of bestsellers. So there's no way that you can curate a thoughtful, high-quality library collection out of that. So, that's just stock that you would be able to spend that 20 million on buying a few books ahead per child to get those libraries up to scratch. That's before talking about any other kind of, a professional librarian to staff the library or to guide the children or anything else on top of it.
All right. And just before we let you go then, Elena, as we said there that you have launched Ask Children's Books Ireland your pre-budget submission today. What else does it entail apart from that 20 million euro funding that you're calling for?
We're asking for a couple of things. So in secondary schools, there are a number of JCSP libraries around the country, the Junior Certificate Support Programme, and they are incredible JCSP demonstration libraries. They are staffed by professional librarians, but there are only 30 in the school. And we know that a lot of schools don't have a library. There was always an intention for more than 17 years now to expand the number of libraries. So we're calling on that to happen immediately. And we're also calling on a timeline to be put on a commitment that was recommended by the Joint Committee on Education on the report on leaving certificate reform. There's been a lot of talk about, moving papers and when the exams happen, but this committee recommended that all schools, primary and post-primary, would have a school library with a librarian and full access to the school digital library service. So we're calling for that to happen as well. It would be such a powerful intervention. There's a huge body of research that shows how astonishing the impact of reading can be on children, regardless of what socioeconomic background they're coming from, their parents' level of education. So this might be seen as something soft, but actually it's really crucial that we invest in this right now.
Okay, and just finally, Elena, as I mentioned there as well, you are a charity, Children's Books Ireland. Aside from this pre-budget submission and your engagement with schools and the government, etc., on that aspect, what else do you do at the charity? Would you be looking for donations of books, etc.?
We look for donations financially, certainly, but not for donations of physical books, simply because we're a small team and we can't handle the physical items in and out, and want to guarantee that, particularly in schools where they don't have a lot of books or if we're giving to individual children, that they are the absolute best and that they're brand new. But yes, we are a charity. We always really welcome donations via childrensbooksireland.ie. And we do a huge amount of work. So if parents are listening in, they can get onto our website. website, childrensbooksireland.ie, and we have an awful lot of themed reading lists. So for kids who are starting school, you might want some books about that. You might want some books about making friends. We have lists of graphic novels, historical fiction, all sorts of things, as well as, you know, reading guides and regular review. We also support artists so that they can make great work for children and young people. And we do a lot of book gifting, so directly buying libraries for schools that don't have them. And we do a lot of that through the year. If you have a look at the news section of our website, you can see some of the schools that we're working with.
Okay, super stuff. CEO of Children's Books Ireland, Elena Ryan, thanks indeed for taking our call this afternoon, Elena, and good afternoon to you. Now, just going back to the issue of traffic, and we said that there was a crash on the M7 heading northbound just before the M7-M9 merge. That appears to be cleared up, but traffic is still very heavy in both directions in Newbridge, and that's right the way down from the Ballymoney Curragh roundabout to the other side of Newbridge, which is essentially as the Pfizer roundabout, and traffic more or less at a standstill there in both directions. So if you can avoid Newbridge town centre, you would be best advised to do so. Also, still not sure what the situation is on the Kildare to Nerney road around Kilburn there. It seems to be quite heavy at the Clonolan area and Shanaclun. So if anyone is in that area, you might let us know. Traffic is heavy at Tully as well, around the National Stud and St. Bridget's Well. So do get in touch if there is an accident there that's worth mentioning, or perhaps it is just sheer volume of people out and about enjoying the bit of sunshine and going to the National Stud, etc. Right, Kildare Public Participation Network will hold its third annual Climate Action Weekend from Friday the 9th to Sunday the 11th of September 2022. The programme is designed to be informative but also to highlight the work of active and passionate community groups who are driving change, raising awareness and supporting climate initiatives in their own towns and villages. Well, on the line is Cliona Kelleher. She's a member of the Kildare Public Participation Network. She's also a founder of the Climate Action Weekend. Cliona, good afternoon. You're very welcome to Kildare Focus.
Hi, Owen. How are you?
I'm good. So we're going to be talking about, you know, what's happening over the next weekend or so, because it is happening on the 9th to the 11th of September. So not this weekend, the weekend after. A lot of work, though, has got into planning this. What can people expect?
This, as you said, this is our third year running it, and we're really excited about this year's event. We've loads on. So, for example, on the Friday, we have our headline event, which is looking at Kildare's energy future. And we have Emer Conway, who's Kildare's Sustainable Energy Community Mentor. So that will be a discussion around all the energy aspects of climate. And then we've a huge range of other activities. There's something for everybody, really. We've a Birdwatch Ireland talk, a walk on Lodge Bog done by the Irish Peatland Conservation Council. We've parenting. We've a Farming for Nature walk. Absolutely loads. And it's a mix of online and in-person, so hopefully accessible for everybody.
That's the point that I was going to make there. It's great now that we can get back to in-person events that are happening, because I think it was last year or the year before that I logged on to a couple of these events and they were very, very informative. But the fact now that you can get out and walk along the Lodge Bog, there's going to be a walk along the Corbally Canal line. That's where the bird watch is taking place, and other things that are happening around the county as well. It really gives you a better feel for the biodiversity within the county as well.
Absolutely, and we've such a great range of experts, and you know, I think the energy in person is nicer, and you also, you know, you have a chance to connect with people and, you know, share knowledge or just get to know each other. So it has that lovely social aspect as well.
Yeah, there's a Farming for Nature farm walk taking place in McCall's Farm in Calverstown to showcase various sustainable and environmentally friendly farming practices. There's a number of experts coming on then as well. Dr. Colin Byrne is going to talk about air quality in the towns and villages, and Dr. Owen Gallivan and Anne Walsh are hosting a discussion on psychology and the climate crisis. So as you say, Cliona, there is something there for everyone.
Absolutely, yeah. And the air quality one is great. We're delighted to have Dr. Colin Byrne because, you know, pollution and carbon emissions, we often don't realise that they have quite severe health impacts, you know, when there's a lot of pollution in areas. So that's going to be really interesting. And I'm also really looking forward to the psychology one, because I think that's a whole, you know, how do we approach behaviour change? You know, how do we deal with all the different issues around it? Because it is so complex, obviously.
Okay, now we will be mentioning this closer to the time as well, but we just wanted to kind of let people know and get them thinking about next, or the weekend after the 9th to the 11th of September. This is when the annual Climate Action Weekend is taking place. All the events, I believe, Cliona, are open to all. They're free to attend, but some of them have limited capacity, so you're urged to go on and book your place online.
Yes, exactly. Everything is open, and just a few of them are restricted by numbers. So there, for those ones, there will be Eventbrite registration on the website. Everything can be found on the Kildare PPN website. So it's kildarepn.ie/climate-action-weekend. And also the PPN is on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. So there'll be updates ongoing in the next while on everything.
Yeah, the Kildare PPN is the main link through which the local authority connects with the social inclusion, environmental and community and voluntary groups within County Kildare. And as Cliona said, the website is www.kildarepn.ie, and we'll be announcing some of those events that are taking place in the next couple of weeks here on KFM. But good to talk to you this afternoon. Cliona Kelleher, member of the Kildare PPN Secretariat and founder of the Climate Action Weekend. Thanks for joining us.
Kildare Focus with Owen Beattie.
Yeah, I've been looking forward to this chat, I have to say, since the start of the programme, even though it makes the hair stand up on the back of my neck a little bit. False widow spiders are up to 230 times more poisonous than native Irish species, new research has found. The research conducted by scientists from the Ryan Institute in NUI Galway looked at how the species has been so successful at spreading in towns and cities worldwide. Dr. John Dunbar is Irish Research Council postdoctoral fellow and co-senior author of the study. He's on the line. Good afternoon to you, John.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me on.
No problem at all. So over the last 5 years, the team at NUI Galway's Venom Systems Lab, led by Dr. Michael Dugan, have been studying a wide range of characteristics specific to the species of false widow spiders, including its venom, symptoms of envenomation, ecology and behaviour. Tell us a little bit more about this study then, what you've been doing, John.
Yeah, so we wanted to assess the potential competitiveness of the false widow spider against native species to see how much of a threat they pose. And what we did was we took venom from the false widow and from the number of native species, and then tested the venom on our native species to see how they react to the venom. And what we found was, in comparison to the native species, the false widow spider was hundreds of times more potent.
Yeah, it's hard to believe that there's that much of a difference. And I know that you've been following kind of what other species that the false widow spider preys on. And 95% of the time, the false widow spider killed and ate its opponents.
Yes. Part of the reason for this is because the noble false widow evolved over many thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of years in other regions of the world, where they would compete with a much more competitive range of species. And then they arrived to a small island like Ireland, but also in the UK as well. We don't have quite as many species in comparison to, for example, continental Europe. So it's kind of a little easier for them to outcompete them.
Yeah, they originate from Madeira, which is just off the coast of Portugal, and also the Canary Islands as well, as I understand it. They're mainly active after dark and typically prey on a wide range of insects and other arachnids, but has also been documented preying on a lizard in Ireland. And sometimes, John, they prey on other bigger species like shrews or bats, etc.
Yes, that's correct. And not surprising, they're close relatives. Other species of Steatota and other, in fact, true black widows, which they're closely related to, regularly feed on small vertebrates like snakes and lizards, mammals, and they're just extremely good at taking advantage of available resources in the environment. And here in Ireland, we're not used to seeing things like this with our native species. We're not used to people complaining of bites by spiders. Mm. We're not used to people arriving in the emergency services after being bitten. But here we are with this spider that arrived only probably 20, 25 years ago and has absolutely turned all our thoughts around on our local spider populations.
Yeah, how many of them would we have in Ireland, John, and where could we find them?
Not to scare your listeners there, but we are literally in the millions.
Wow.
When I go searching for them in Dublin, they are the most common spider that I find.
Really?
It's not to say that we don't see native spiders, of course we do, but the noble false widow significantly outnumbers them.
I thought you were going to say maybe, 5 or 10, they're very rare, but no, they're very, very common. Where do you find them then? Whereabouts would they be hiding?
I'd say in Dublin, where I mostly go looking, I'd say probably most back gardens would have them. That's how widespread they are. But you're talking all along the east coastal counties, down around Cork, Galway, up the north, Kildare, Mullingar, Longford. We've actually documented them in quite a range of counties in Ireland. And most of the habitats you'll find them is in fences, steel railings, sheds, kind of on the outside of the frames of windows and so on. Usually I find them quite a lot where timber or railings meet concrete blocks, concrete walls and so on. And yeah, if you look in your garden, as it gets dark, take out a torch and shine around, and you might see one. They kind of stand out, they hang upside down on the web, and you'll see this really impressive cream stripe going along the front of their abdomen.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. How would you identify a false widow spider? But also, size-wise, what are we talking?
Size-wise, we're probably talking, they're not as big as the giant house spider that we see every year, and they're just like this time of the year, just runs out from under the couch and everyone gets a fright. So they're actually much smaller than those. But they do regularly feed on the giant house spider. They are usually kind of dark brown. The small juveniles, sub-adults, and the males are usually vibrantly coloured. But as the females mature, the coloration becomes very dark.
Right, I'm just looking here at a photograph on the internet, just while we're talking there, and I have definitely seen those spiders in the back garden, 100%. What about how dangerous they are to humans then, John? Take us through that, because as we know, their venom is 230 times more poisonous than native species. Is that more kind of when they're attacking kind of other smaller species and insects, or how dangerous can they be to humans?
Yes, so the specific study was to investigate the ecological importance of them, the invasive potential. So the study was focused on spider models, arachnid models. So the potency would not necessarily be the same if we were to test this on mammals or even vertebrates. But we do know after a recent study we did a couple of years ago, we investigated the composition of the venom, and it mostly overlapped with true black widows, and it had all the necessary important potent neurotoxins that makes black widows dangerous to people. Mm. But it's important to kind of put some context to it. Most black widow species are in other parts of the world are your typical garden spider. People live with them all around the world with mostly no problems. Black widow bites, typically 70% of bites don't require even a visit to the GP. Mm. Only a small percent are actually more severe and very rarely fatal. But in the case of the noble false widow, we're only recently starting to document these bites, and there's actually only 24 recorded in the medical literature. And of these, most are quite mild. You're talking about really sharp, intense pain, swelling, and so on. And this can resolve after a number of hours or days. But there are, even within this small case series. There are a number of cases in Ireland and England where people have been hospitalised from debilitating pain. People have experienced body tremors. And then also minor necrosis, irregular heartbeats, irregular heart rates, and in some cases, bacterial infections. We had one case where a victim was actually hospitalised for a number of months from debilitating bacterial infections.
Yeah, it's crazy to think an insect that small can have such an impact on humans. I know that this study that you were doing was the ecological impact of them. They are related to the black widow, are they?
Yeah, they're closely related to the black widows. And well, what's interesting, one of the parts of the study was we assessed their capability of making calculated decisions on using their venom, because they have a very tiny, they've got a tiny fraction of venom. Half a microliter of venom is kind of the most that we've extracted from them. And this is tiny. So they need to use this very sparingly. And they can actually, if they use some of their venom, they will be calculated in how to use the rest of the venom. If they encounter a prey, they would be strategic in how to use it. They will always go for the head or the thorax, where they can target the nervous system more efficiently. But also, they will avoid prey that might be a bit dangerous until a few days, a few weeks, when they recuperate their venom. Then they will take on much bigger animals. And this has a knock-on effect when you take into consideration bites to humans, because how people are bitten depends on how much of a threat they're perceived by the spider.
Yeah.
So if the spider's caught in clothing, because they are, I'll just iron out there, they are not aggressive. You can handle them and they won't bite. Typically, people are bitten because the spider got trapped in clothing. And so sometimes they might just give a bite and nobody knows the quantity of venom they deliver. So the range of symptoms that we experience may be if the spider didn't feel that threatened, they just gave you a little nip, or the people who experienced the really severe symptoms may have made a spider feel even more threatened, and they might have decided, okay, I need to give much more venom in this bite.
Okay, just to finish up then, John, because you mentioned there that they have such a small amount of venom in there, and, you know, obviously you had to extract that. To be a little bit nerdy then, how was the extraction process carried out? Because I'd imagine you have to be very, very particular to be able to extract the venom from a noble false widow spider.
Yes, it's quite frustrating at times, because I used to work I used to help extract venom from venomous snakes, and with a single snake we'd get a shot glass full of venom.
Right.
And with the false widow spiders, they're so tiny, to get the equivalent of a raindrop, we would have to extract venom from hundreds of false widow spiders. So it's quite tedious. So what we do is we capture the animals, we have them in the lab, and then we put them under CO2 so they go quite sleepy for a few minutes. And then we put them on our apparatus, and then we give them a light electrical shock, and that kind of contracts the muscles.
Yeah.
A little drop of venom comes out, and then we put them back in their container and they wake up and they're fine.
Right. Very, very interesting, I have to say. And it's been great talking to you on the programme this afternoon. That is Dr. John Dunbar, Irish Research Council postdoctoral fellow and co-senior author of that study, False Widow Spiders, up to 230 times more poisonous than native species, according to that study. Thanks for joining us, John, and good afternoon. That just about wraps up Kildare Focus for this afternoon. Ciara is back tomorrow. I will talk to you tomorrow morning on the Kildare Today programme between 9 and 11. Thomas Meyer is up next with K-Drive Classic Gold. Great music from the 60s, 70s, 80s and 90s.